was looking at me like I was crazy. Despite that error, the turnout confirmed that the world was still hungry for that Mobb Deep sound. Jadakiss, Styles P, and Sheik Looch from the Locks squeezed through the VIP area after the show to show some love. It was extremely crowded, so Havoc and I stood up on the couch to get some breathing room. Havoc spotted a video vixen he used to mess with named Erica, a good-looking Latina female who rode in the passenger seat of Fabulous GT Bentley in the Breathe video. Hav pulled her up onto the couch where we were standing when he spotted another one of his chicks. "Keep an eye on Erica," he told me as he headed toward the other woman. "All right, cool," I said. Erica was just as twisted as I was, and Havoc was gone for a long time. So I grabbed her in front of me, my arms wrapped around her waist, my hands at the front of her black cocktail dress. "What's really good, Ma?" I whispered in her ear. "Whatever," she said. I put my hand up the front of her dress and started finger popping her right there on the couch in front of everybody. She ain't had no panties on. "You coming with me," I said. "Let's go." "Cool, I'm with you," she said. I took her hand and led her to the exit. As we were walking to the parking lot, Havoc rolled up in his G-Wagon Benz. "Erica, get over here," he shouted. "Chill, son, we see you later on," I yelled. But Havoc demanded that she get into his truck. Erica let go of my hand and bounced with Hav. Wow, the vultures were out that night. I know Kiki's reading this saying, "Aha, good for you." After a couple of months of preparing and rehearsing my lines, I flew to Los Angeles to film Full Clip with Busta Rhymes, Xzibit, and Tiny Lister. The production people set me up in a room at Le Meridian in West Hollywood for 2 weeks. I played an ex-Marine sniper called into town by Xzibit, who also played an ex-Marine, to take over a small town alongside Tiny Lister and Busta Rhymes' hype man Split Star. I learned a lot from an on-set acting coach as well as Tiny Lister, who schooled me onto the inside information about Hollywood. The entire movie, which was very low budget, was shot in an old hotel downtown Los Angeles with tons of homeless people in makeshift tents and cardboard refrigerator boxes on the sidewalk. On set, Tiny flipped out on the production crew if they made him wait more than 5 minutes to shoot his parts. He acted just like Debo from Friday. "That's how you gotta do these fools, Prodigy," Tiny pulled me to the side and said. "You gotta remind them that you're a professional. Look at them. I bet they won't ever call me on my trailer again unless they sure they're ready." And they didn't. Across the street from the hotel, the production crew rented a parking lot with 5 trailers for the main actors. Busta Rhymes and Xzibit's trailers were the biggest and most modern, with a queen-size bed, full bathroom, kitchen, dining area, dressing room, and a living room with TV, stereo, and games. Mine was a small trailer with a 3-seated couch, makeup mirror, and bathroom. Split Stars was right next to mine. We smoked and talked in each other's trailers and became real cool. There's a scene where he and I get into an argument while playing pool, and Tiny Lister breaks us up before we start fighting. We had to act serious, but kept busting out laughing. After the first day of filming, I called Kiki. She said she wanted to fly out to spend a week with me. She'd never been to California. The next day on set, I saw this kid, Sean, one of the best tap dancers in my grandmother's dance school, whom I hadn't seen since I was 13. He'd become an actor and was playing a cop in the movie. Alchemist and Twin were in town, and we were chilling in Xzibit's trailer after wrapping up for the day. Xzibit said he was taking acting seriously and had a lot of scripts coming his way. He had just gotten a script for another movie called Gridiron Gang, starring The Rock. Xzibit was our loud label mate for years, so we've hung out on several occasions. He invited us to his crib. Alchemist had somewhere to go, but Twin and I hopped in Xzibit's Hummer to his modern multi-level house in the hills. We played video games in the living room and met Xzibit's son and his woman. Busta Rhymes showed up an hour later, along with Paul Rosenberg, Alchemist and Eminem's manager. Exhibit, who was the host of MTV's Pimp My Ride, took us into his garage and showed us his 6-4 Impala lowrider. The next day, I strolled around the Beverly Center Mall with 40 Glock and his boys, buying white tees and sneakers and checking out ladies. A petite, light-skinned female with blonde hair, a sun visor, and a tennis skirt so short you could see her panties was going up the escalator. I left the group of 12 dudes I was with and went up behind her. When we got to the top, I asked her name. Keisha, she said. Keisha was beautiful. When I was typing her number into my phone, 40 Glock and all the homies walked up. Keisha got a little nervous, but then she realized they were with me and calmed down. I called Keisha as soon as we got back to the room. 40 Glock kept saying that I should have brought her back with me. What's up? It's P. Where you at? On my way back to the studio, Keisha said. I've got a session today. What, do you rap or something? What you do? I asked. I sing. I'm doing a song for the Barbershop 2 soundtrack. You should come hang out with me over here. A word? We just did a song for that soundtrack. I got a group called Mobb Deep. Yeah, I know who you are, she said. Come to my studio session so you can hear my songs. Damn, I can't. I'm doing a movie out here and I got to breeze by the set soon. Why you don't stop by my hotel so we can kick it before your session? Can't. I'm late. Why don't you stop by before you go to the movie set? We went back and forth on the phone a few times that day, but that was all. After the first week of filming, I flew in my lady Kiki to be with me. Kiki got out the cab from the airport and walked through the trailer parking lot in a tight jogging suit that you could almost see through. Split Star and others were trying to talk to her because they didn't know she was coming to see me. She knocked on the trailer door and we hugged and kissed. She told me right away about everybody who tried to talk to her on her way in. Kiki always told me when people I know try to talk to her. It didn't bother me at all because Kiki's so beautiful that every man alive would try if he had enough heart. I enjoyed it. It meant I was doing something right. I knew Kiki probably had her little things on the side, but she was serious only about me. The other fools were just for play. Even though I messed around with a lot of other women while I was with my boys, I turned down the baddest female to stay with my woman because I loved her. Those other females were meaningless. Kiki watched me on the set that day. Then we took it back to the hotel. The next morning, after room service breakfast, I saw Split Star in the lobby. He told me the front desk had been robbed the night before. Two dudes with shotguns rushed the hotel office and stole a few $1,000s. After sharing that story, Split told me that Cameron was out front. Cameron was standing outside with his man Jim Jones. I hadn't seen Cam since we did Losing Weight together. I was wearing a white and pink striped polo shirt I bought for my man Keith Starr in Harlem. White shorts, white felines, and my infamous Records 40-inch chain. Cam introduced me to Jim and told me that he saw my movie Murder Music and liked it. I didn't want to leave Kiki by herself for too long, so we talked briefly. I said peace to Cam and Jim and went back upstairs. It seemed like after Cameron saw me rocking my pink polo shirt, he went pink crazy. I was known to throw on a pink polo shirt every now and again since 1989. I went to high school in Manhattan with a lot of Brooklyn dudes who were in gangs like Decepticons and Low Lives. That's where the trend of hood niggas rocking pink started. Brooklyn dudes wore pink polo sweaters, purple, orange, and yellow. Brooklyn motherfuckers loved polo when I was in high school. I just kept the trend going in 2003. Now maybe it's just a coincidence, but I never saw Cameron wear pink before that day in L.A. A few days after Kiki left to get back to our kids, we finished filming. Alchemist, Twin, and I drove to Las Vegas to chill for a few days before flying back to New York. But before we hit the highway for Vegas, we stopped at Alchemist's homeboy, Mr. Cartoon's tattoo and car shop to get my first Mr. Cartoon tat. I want a half an angel, Half a demon on the back of my neck, I told him. On our way to Vegas, we drove through the Death Valley Desert, where the average temperature is over 100 degrees Fahrenheit. But as we drove through, we saw snow all across the desert. Yes, snow. It was extremely rare for it to snow in Death Valley. I took it as a sign that major changes in our lives were about to take place. We checked into the Hilton Hotel and Casino. Alchemist was a crap table junkie. He taught me how to play. I'm not a gambler because I don't like giving away my money, but sometimes I blow a few thousand hoping to win. Not on that trip. I turned $300 into $800 playing the dollar slots, kept gambling, and ended up with $280. Alchemist was another story. That boy stood at the crap table for 8 hours straight, winning and losing, losing and winning, with a crazed zombie look on his face. Back home, our new album was doing well, but Jive suddenly didn't want to give us control of the marketing and promotion budget. I had a list of promotional items that I wanted to give away at our concerts and other events, but the marketing team didn't seem excited about the album anymore. America's Nightmare sold roughly 400,000 copies and was creeping his way to gold. So it was strange to see that Jive was losing interest so fast. But Jive was used to selling millions of albums with Britney Spears, R. Kelly, NSYNC, and others. Mobb Deep was small-time sales compared to their major-selling artists. I was really upset with Jive and Chris Lighty because I had the know-how to help America's Nightmare sell triple the amount that it sold. All I needed was my marketing and promotion plan approved, and for Jive to cut the check. This was a clear sign that the deal wouldn't last long. I miss Loud Records and Steve Rifkin. Steve understood the power of street promo. Not corporate promo, street promo. Together we understood our core audience and exactly how to reach them. Oh well. We had to make the best of the hand we were dealt. It was 3 a.m. And I just made the 40-minute drive home from our Queen studio to Rockland. Hickey and the kids were fast asleep. And I was tired but couldn't fall asleep. I hooked up my son's PlayStation to my bedroom TV and played Freedom Fighters until heaviness crept under my eyelids at 4:30 a.m. It was a crisp, clear night, so I could see the stars and the moon from the large window next to our bed that looked down on the whole block. Our mountaintop home was the highest on our block. We didn't have curtains or blinds covering that window because nobody could see in. We could see out. Suddenly, all the power went out. I looked out the window and saw that the whole block was blacked out, so I decided to go to bed. As I lay down next to Kiki, a bright white light beamed into our bedroom window. It looked like a police helicopter's searchlight, except it was silent. Oh, shit. Are the police looking for somebody over here? Kiki, get up. I reached over to wake Kiki. Look at this shit. The bright white beam began changing colors. Red, yellow, green, blue, orange, repeating randomly. Do you see this shit? I asked. What the fuck is that? Kiki said. Do you see this shit? Yes. Go look out the window and see what that is, she said. I'm not going near that window. I knew what it was. A UFO was hovering over our crib, shining light beams in top bedroom. Holy shit. After 3 or 4 minutes, the night sky turned black again. I was happy that Kiki was with me, so I had a witness this time. When the sky turned black again, a feeling of fear took over. Something is in our house. And the power came back on. I peeked down at the other houses on our block, and all the power was back on. Kiki must have had the same feeling that I had. Go check on the kids, she said. I'm not going to check on shit, I replied. I was shook. Nigga, go check on the kids, she barked. You go, I said. But I got the shotgun from the closet, woke the kids up, and brought them into our room. What's going on? the kid's ass half asleep. "Mommy and I just seen a UFO," I told him. "Where?" Tasia said. "I want to see it too." "It's gone now," Kiki said. "Get in our bed." I sat on the edge of the bed with the shotgun in my hands as my family slept, still in shock. Maybe my fear was just guilt because I wasn't living right, and subconsciously I thought I was in trouble. Or maybe it was all the movies I'd seen. At 6 a.m., as the sun started shining, I went to sleep. I had been begging and praying for another sign from the Most High and for a witness to see it with me. After Kiki and I had that extremely close encounter, I was convinced that the ancient Egyptian teachings that Dr. York revealed in his books were facts beyond a shadow of a doubt. I knew the truth about many of life's mysteries, but I was stuck smoking, drinking, and not walking the straight line that I was taught to follow when I knew better. I felt like a fallen angel. The UFO came to my house to show me the light, as if to say, "Wake up, nigga. Snap out of it. We are real, and you are important to us. Okay, gotta go for now. Hope you're ready when we come back." I'm not talking about little green Martians and all that science fiction crap. So say the prodigy believes in little green men from Mars routine. It's much deeper than you know. Only deal with the truth and facts that have been concealed from humans of all races, because discovering these facts would collapse the mountain of lies and corruption. A mind-boggling amount of misinformation is released through movies, books, religion, education, and news to confuse us. Every race of people has its own truth, history, and origin. Black people's ancient ancestors don't share the same mental, physical, or spiritual composition as us. They were far more advanced. But they created us in their likeness, and we carried on their traits, many of which were cut off or watered down due to our own foolish ways, crossbreeding with other races. Melanin has very powerful physical and spiritual properties, and the mental enslavement and brainwashing that we were put through. When people like myself discover the truth and attempt to share it with others, some will say, "Prodigy is a racist conspiracy theorist. He watches too much science fiction. He's a wacko." I was receiving the gift of enlightenment from my ancient black ancestors, the Most High and the universe. But as much as I thought I knew, I had a lot to learn about self-control. I was acting like a late baby, too comfortable in mommy's warm, dark stomach to come out and deal with reality. It was way beyond 9 months, and I was refusing to be born. Back in fantasy land, home of the dumb, deaf, blind, and blissfully ignorant, Mobb Deep booked a concert in a small town near Albany called Cahos. Havoc, Alchemist, Twin, Noy, Derek, this tall security guard with dreads, and I were driven in a turtle top van outfitted with a TV, DVD player, and a PlayStation 4 hours upstate. Derek was acting as our road manager and went to collect a payment from the venue before we walked in. 10 minutes later, he said the promoter didn't have all the bread yet because they were still collecting the money from the door. So we found a parking spot in the cut and waited in the van until they were ready. Alchemist lit a blunt in the meantime. 20 minutes later, a cop knocked on the passenger window while a security guard was seated. "Oh shit, put the weed out," we said, scrambling. Twin lit a cigarette to hide the smell. The security guard rolled down the window. "What are you doing over here?" the cop asked. "We're performing at the club, just waiting for the promoter to pay us before we head inside," the security guard explained. "Oh yeah? So why do I smell marijuana?" the cop asked. "No, that's just cigarette smoke. No marijuana over here," the security guard replied. "We're just waiting to do our concert." "Yeah, I smell marijuana," the cop said. "We'll see when the canine gets here. Turn the vehicle off." He called the canine unit, the police dogs that sniff for drugs. Ah, man. I had a .25 caliber in my jacket pocket, my usual gun for clubs, shows, or out of town. I quickly put the gun in my Timberland boot under my right foot. Squad cars rolled up within a few minutes. Alchemist pulled a big bag of weed, an ounce of kush, from his jacket. "Yo, take this for me, son," he said to Twin, seated beside him. "Hold this." Twin looked at the size of the bag and said, "I'm not going down for all that. I'm not taking that shit. You bugging, son." Twin and Alchemist quietly argued over who should take the weed. In the past, Twin told Alchemist that if they were ever in a situation like this, Twin would take the weight. But Twin meant a 20 or 50 bag, not the Ziploc pillow that Alchemist pulled out. "Why would you bring that much anyway?" Twin asked. "It's not like we were going away for a week." "Fuck it, forget it," Alchemist said, putting the pillow back into his pocket. A cop approached the van, shining his flashlight. "Everybody step out the van," he ordered. "One at a time." Alchemist got out first. The cop pulled the Ziploc weed pillow from Al's pocket and held it in the air for the other cops to see. I was relieved that the cop didn't ask Al to take off his sneakers. I got out next. The cop frisked me, searched my pockets, and was done. That was a close call, I thought. "What are those? Timberlands?" he said, looking down at my boots. "Yeah." "Take your boots off." Damn. I took off my Timbs and prepared myself mentally. "He's got a gun in his boot," cop alerted the other cops. They pulled out their guns and made us lie on the ground, dragged everybody else out the van, cuffed us, and searched the vehicle. The security guard with the dreads started sobbing uncontrollably. "I can't go to jail, man. Please, I got kids," he pleaded. "I didn't do anything." Twin Noid and I laughed. It was funny to see a 6'10", 300-pound fool cry. The driver, an unassuming older black man, had a duffel bag in the back of the van. The cop searched the bag and found crack cocaine and a box of 9mm bullets. We looked at each other like, "Crack? Bullets?" That's why the dude was speeding so fast the entire drive upstate. He was high on crack. The cops must have been happy as hell. At the precinct, Havoc, Noid, Twin, Derek, and the security guard were released, and they kept Alchemist, the driver, and me. Twin agreed to call Kiki and contact my lawyer, Bob Kalina. I fell asleep on a hardwood bench attached to the cell wall. The next morning, the judge let Alchemist go without bail and hit me with $20,000 bail. Until I could get the money, I was transferred to the Albany County Jail, 20 minutes away from the precinct. After I was processed, they handed me a jumpsuit, jail shoes that looked like Van skateboard sneakers, sheets, a blanket, mug, toothbrush, toothpaste, and a rule book, and directed me to my tier. "Yo, that's Prodigy," a few inmates yelled out. "No, that's Havoc, nigga. Mob Deep." As I walked to my cell, I noticed the van driver a few cells down from mine, sweating bullets like he was going through withdrawal from his crack habit. He looked scared. "Are you okay?" I asked, stopping at his cell gate. Yeah, I'm all right," he said, looking at me as if he couldn't recognize me. "I'm about to put my shit in my cell and use the jack," I said, meaning the phone. "You want me to make a call for you?" "Yeah, please," he said. He told me he didn't have anything to write with, so I asked one of the inmates to borrow a pencil and wrote down his number. I called Kiki. She cursed me out for getting locked up again and told me that she and Havoc were putting my bail together. Then I called Mr. Crackman's number, but nobody picked up. Oh well. I told him to be easy and try to calm his nerves. Gave homeboy his pencil back and locked in. Hours later, the chow wagon came around with dinner and an officer called my name, saying I was bailed out. Yes. Back in the city, I stopped in the Bronx to see Derek, who'd driven the van back from Albany and parked it in a lot a few blocks from his apartment building. Derek and I walked over to the lot so I can get some CDs and DVDs that I left in the van. We looked at each other and couldn't resist the temptation. Yes, we took everything of value out of that vehicle. We gutted it out. The TV, PlayStation, DVD player, stereo, speakers, and navigation system. Thank you, goodbye. A few days later, I called Bob Kalina.
I'm sitting here looking at your address, and guess what?
Bob said.
You live around the corner from me. I live in Pomona, too. My guy at Albany is trying to work out a deal because it's looking like an illegal search. We'll see. I'll pick you up and we'll drive to the courthouse together if you want.
Sounds good, I said. He told me the court date would be in 2 weeks. When I finished my call with Bob Kalina, I got a call from my mother.
Chaka, I just read on the internet that you got arrested with a gun and crack. Are you smoking crack?
What? Hell no, Ma, I said. The driver had crack in his bag, not me.
Oh, thank God.
The media was making it seem like I was smoking crack. Ha! The next morning, Kiki asked me to go to the supermarket. My Denali needed gas, so I pulled in the Exxon on Route 59, 2 minutes from my house. While I was pumping gas, a black BMW X5 truck with tinted windows pulled into the station and stopped suddenly while it was headed toward the pumps, backed up, then pulled up next to the driver's side of my truck. I opened my passenger door and discreetly put my 9mm Ruger on my waist. Yes, I was still carrying guns after I just got arrested for one a few days before. 2.2s, 9s, 25s, and 45 calibers. My life don't stop just because I got arrested. The drama doesn't stop, I reminded myself. Wherever and whenever, never get caught slipping. A dark-skinned dude with dreads hopped out the X5.
Yo, Prodigy, what up, man?
He walked toward me.
My name is Ronnie. I seen you around the town. I'm from Spring Valley. I'm working on a knockout DVD. A lot of hood fights and shit like that. I've got my camera in the truck, if you don't mind doing a drop for me.
Knockout DVD? Is he gonna try to knock me out on camera? See, this is why I got a gun on my waist, for fools like this, I thought to myself. No problem, I said. Get your camera. What's the name of your DVD? Paper Chase, he said, camera in hand. Yo, what's up? This the head nigga in charge, Prodigy from the infamous Mobb Deep. You are now watching the Paper Chase DVD. Peace. After recording the drop, Ronnie gave me one of his DVDs, and I got in my truck and bounced. 2 weeks later, my Albany case was dropped to a misdemeanor and dismissed. I was ordered to pay a fine and stay out of trouble for 2 years. I don't know how Bob Kalina and his Albany lawyer friend pulled it off. Your luck is gonna run out, Kiki said. You need to stop getting arrested with those guns. Even Twin would say, you got bagged with mad hammers and stay beating the cases. Niggas gonna think you snitching soon, son. Snitch? Never. But my luck was damn sure about to run out. When you build an extensive criminal record, after a while the judge and prosecutor can hit you based on your history. My criminal history cup was about to spill over. We booked a show in Connecticut with 50 Cent, Mobb Deep, and G-Unit's first performance together. I was real excited. The promoter rented a turtle top van, as usual, and a driver. I decided to drive my white Yukon Denali. I wasn't bringing a gun, but I was leery about hired drivers since our last one had cracking bullets in his van. The whole crew bought navy blue t-shirts and bandanas to wear for the show. No gang significance. We just wanted to look in sync since this was an important show. Little Lord, Havoc, Rondo, Fly, and Derek rode in the van. Illa G, Alchemist, and I took my truck. We left Manhattan at 10 p.m. and got to the club at midnight. It was packed.